ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Something needs to be done, and I appreciate obviously the government coming on board and obviously trying to do different things, but I'm just trying to protect my members and make sure that they're protected in what they're doing and make sure that they're doing the right thing according to law so they don't find themselves in trouble later on.
Legal advice sought by the Northern Territory Police Union has raised concerns about whether police have legal grounds to enforce the two-week curfew imposed on young people in Alice Springs. We'll head there shortly. And how far would you go to solve a mystery? Would you put yourself or your 10-year-old child through hours of excruciating pain? We'll learn about the man who did just that, to solve a case that's forever changed how North Queenslanders use the beach.
Jack decided that he should determine that this was once and for all the animal that caused Irukandji syndrome. And so he said, now we need to get a volunteer so we can sting them. The lifesavers were not at all keen, to say the least.
I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth. We start in Alice Springs, a town nearly a week into a two-week youth curfew that was imposed last Wednesday following antisocial behaviour. The curfew bans all young people under the age of 18 from being in the CBD from the hours of 6pm through to 6am. Now, the union representing the Territory's police, the Northern Territory Police Association, has warned the curfew may be unlawful and could put their members at risk legally. Reporter Miles Holbrook-Walk is on the ground in Alice Springs covering this issue and he joins us now. Miles, can you talk us through these concerns raised by the Territory Police Union?
Sure, Alex. So basically, this is a really interesting piece of legal correspondence that the ABC was able to obtain, where essentially the union representing police, who are the ones on the ground, in part, largely enforcing this curfew, that means under 18-year-olds, not allowed on the CBD between 6pm to 6am, their own union has issued this independent legal note to them saying, basically, we don't think this is lawful. And the reason they don't think it's lawful is because they're drawing from laws in the Northern Territory called the Emergency Management Act, which allows the government to claim extraordinary powers around the movement of people around what can be deemed a high-risk area, but they're typically only supposed to do this, in this legal representative's reading of the case, to be only when it's something like floods, fires. Of course, remember COVID, where we saw a whole bunch of restrictions on our movement in and around many jurisdictions, right? And so that is essentially the context in which we find the Emergency Management Act. But there's this interesting tidbit within it which says that you can't do this in the case of a riot or other civil disturbances. And the government has basically said, well, actually, it's not because of any singular riot or civil disturbance, but broadly for the state of play. And what that has meant is that we've seen Nathan Finn then come out publicly, raise these concerns and say that he's actually had to warn his own police officers on the beat that they could, they should be mindful, rather, about any potential law breaches in applying this curfew order. Here's Nathan Finn.
The legalities of the curfew is that it's under the Emergency Management Act, which obviously replaces the Disasters Act. It refers to natural disasters and obviously events in certain areas. This is actually dealing with a number of stuff in relation to emergency management. We believe that this is directly played into that, and under Section 4 of that Emergency Management Act, it's actually potentially unlawful that this curfew. Obviously, there's something needs to be done, and I appreciate, obviously, the government coming on board and obviously trying to do different things, but I'm just trying to protect my members and make sure that they're protected in what they're doing and make sure that they're doing the right thing according to law so they don't find themselves in trouble later on.
That's Police Union President Nathan Finn there. So, Miles, what could this potentially mean?
Well, it is an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, if there was a legal challenge, could that mean there was a halt to the curfew? Essentially, we don't know yet because that hasn't been raised. And the government has really put it back on several groups and critics of the curfew, saying, one, this is quite popular among locals and indeed frontline organisations, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous led. And that statement, in my experience, just talking to people in Alice Springs and living here, I think is broadly true from the government. But of course, they would say that. And they also, the government is citing advice they've gotten from lawyers, including the Solicitor General, and saying that, you know, if you want to have a legal challenge, we've got great lawyers. Eva Lawler, the Chief Minister in the Northern Territory, more or less yesterday goaded her critics into saying, bring it on, which was this rather extraordinary exchange through the media that took place. But if a challenge was to take place, it would really depend on the jurisdiction it was filed in and whether or not there was a temporary injunction on the curfew, or indeed if they said the curfew could stay in subject to the hearing. There would be a whole bunch of permutations that we still don't know will play out yet. And given that we're already almost halfway through this curfew, at least on paper, its scheduled length, it's hard to see how quickly we could move around this, but you never know. It's not unheard of for courts to hold emergency hearings when there are either protests or matters containing laws that have been brought in very swiftly to be responded to.
Miles, today police have also raised the issue of social media and its role in driving some of this antisocial behaviour. What have Territory Police had to say about this? Are they looking at any strategy to deal with it?
Well, it's really interesting. Police Commissioner Michael Murphy, he's spoken a lot about this idea of people, and it's a phrase used around several states and territories in Australia, the idea of posting and boasting. This is that TikTok and other social media platforms play a particularly incendiary role, where people not only feel the desire to perform criminal acts online and share them amongst each other, but also this idea of one-upmanship, and that I'm going to outdo someone else who's committed a crime here, there, or elsewhere. And this has happened not just, and we've seen police speak about this as well, governments speak about this, not just in the Northern Territory, in huge swathes of Victoria, New South Wales, Queensland, and indeed Western Australia, as well as just some of the places even I've observed coverage and police and governments speaking about this. In New South Wales and Victoria, there are legislative moves to actually particularly target, as a criminal offence, people republishing criminal acts they may commit on social media. We don't have such legislation in the Northern Territory, but the police have spoken in the preceding days since calling this curfew about the idea that that is something that should potentially be considered. Of course, there are a lot of moving pieces all around Alice Springs right now with this ongoing situation, and I dare say the police are saying it's on their agenda. It's just one of many things.
And what have police said about how long they can actually sustain this curfew? We've got 2 weeks at this stage. Is there the likelihood of an extension?
Well, there's certainly an appetite among some groups for it to be extended, and chiefly among some of the schools within Alice Springs, who talk about this idea that school holidays for Alice Springs commence this Friday. So we've had an Easter break where students have gone away. They've come back for the following days up until Friday. And then thereafter, we've got 2 weeks of school holidays. Now, the curfew is scheduled to end quite early on into that stretch, and already Yiparinya School has said, well, we want to continue our schooling services. Now, Yiparinya School is a school that has 100% of its student enrolments as First Nations students, and it is certainly a practitioner where the principal there, Gavin Morris, he's spoken about this idea of that, I want to have school to engage young children and people who are going here to have something to go to, and that I think a curfew and those rules may well successfully keep a sense of quiet around the CBD itself if the curfew is extended. However, it's not so simple. You have around 80 extra police officers currently in Alice Springs, and Commissioner Michael Murphy of the police spoke about this idea that when they move out of their current roles, what that means is that you have a backlog that slowly builds up in all sorts of different roles of policing across the Northern Territory. He explained it here.
So there's actually, detectives that have put their work aside while they come down here in uniform and help the community of Alice Springs. So I can't sustain that for a long time, but there's an investment forthcoming, you know, with the Northern Territory Government, with the police review coming up soon. And we'll see more police, hopefully, into the future, which can help, you know, enforce the laws in Alice Springs.
That's Territory Police Commissioner Michael Murphy there. And finally, Miles, last night was the sixth night of the curfew. What impact has it had on Alice Springs? As a local, what have you noticed?
Well, it's certainly quieter around the CBD. One thing I'm cautious to ascribe that to, though, is the curfew. And I'll just explain, this is just my opinion and something that a few other people I've spoken to who are working, some within frontline organisations, is that it's hard to know early doors whether or not this is the curfew. Is this Easter? Is this wet weather over the last couple of weeks that's cut off certain roads, that's meant the kind of movement between Alice Springs and adjoining remote communities has been more limited. There's a whole range of factors that it's hard to say for sure that the curfew has been the silver bullet or panacea. Indeed, you know, the police would be the first to say that it's not just the curfew that's going to see more safety around town and encouragement indeed of, you know, hopeful things to engage young people with. But by and large, when you speak to most people, they'll talk about the extra presence of police all around the streets within the CBD, from vehicle patrols. We're seeing mounted units as well as police just walking around. They've gone into a lot of licensed venues to monitor responsible service of alcohol. In Alice Springs, there's incredibly strict rules around the sale of alcohol in the town and who can buy alcohol and where it can be taken. And indeed, on Mondays and Tuesdays, so today even, takeaway alcohol shops aren't open. They're closed to the public. And so that's meant that some of the police officers who would typically and who have been brought to Alice Springs during this curfew to help bottle shops are actually being able to engage in other proactive policing, the idea of which being to encourage the situations where particularly they're working with young people to prevent offending. That's what the police keep returning to, this idea that they don't want to try and arrest their way out of this strategy. If anything, what they want to do is help bring some calm to the town and then leave and be able to have police return to their roles elsewhere in the NT, while frontline services, including social work groups, education groups, health groups, are the ones that can really address some of the deeper seated and bigger structural and longer term issues that will need to be worked out and will need to have, you know, funding and solutions-based outlooks to really improve the situation in Alice Springs. And most locals, I think, come back to that conclusion that they're happy to call this a circuit breaker, but they know that it still has elements of being a band-aid, that they're not going to be able to have a curfew indefinitely or in perpetuity, Alex.
Our reporter in Alice Springs is Miles Holbrook-Walk. Miles, thank you once again for speaking to Australia Wide.
Always a pleasure, Alex.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
And you are with me, Alex Hyman. It's great to have your company. Beachgoers across the north of Australia will be all too familiar with the Irukandji jellyfish. If they've not seen one actually in the flesh, they will have seen warning signs on beaches right across the north. But there was once a time when no one knew these tiny creatures existed, only that in summer months, people were going for a swim in the ocean and getting very sick for no apparent reason. In 1961, someone finally worked out what was going on. A Cairns GP named Jack Barnes. It took him years of tenacious detective work to catch these little critters, but to prove once and for all these were the jellyfish responsible, he stung himself and his 10-year-old son, Nick. Nick Barnes told his story to Shani Kim.
It was very calculated. He knew exactly what he was doing. He knew it had not caused a death. It had made one guy quite sick, was in hospital for over a week.
Parenting's a tough gig, and every parent does it their own way. But back on December the 10th, 1961, a doctor named Jack Barnes kind of had a doozy of a parenting moment, which landed him, a lifeguard nicknamed Chiller, and Jack's 10-year-old son Nick in excruciating pain for hours and hours.
My recollection was that Chiller, he was wrapped around the toilet, arms and legs, and heaving his heart out. He was sick as a dog.
Were you crying because of the pain?
Never cried in front of Jack. He was very much the old style ex-commando, and you put up with whatever. Very hard taskmaster. Didn't go to the hospital. Was not allowed to skip school the next day.
That balmy Sunday at Palm Cove, Nick's dad Jack had caught a tiny jellyfish the size of a thumbnail, one never before seen. He'd discovered the extremely small, extremely venomous Irukandji jellyfish.
And everybody wanted to look at it. The lifesavers came over from the clubhouse, and the captain at the time came up the beach, and he had caught another one.
The moment was the culmination of years of detective work. The medical fraternity had been puzzled for decades about a mysterious illness striking down beachgoers in summer in North Queensland. Victims never saw what stung them in the water, but would end up writhing around in pain for hours on end. The illness was coined Irukandji syndrome after a local Aboriginal tribe, but there was no culprit until Nick's dad, Jack, after years of hunting, caught this teeny little jellyfish in a Pyrex dish after it literally swam into his face mask.
Jack decided that he should determine that this was once and for all the animal that caused Irukandji syndrome. And so he said, now we need to get a volunteer so we can sting them. The lifesavers were not at all keen, to say the least.
But Nick, keen as a bean.
Being a lad of that age and wanting to be involved in everything, I said to him, sting me. There was no discussion about what might happen. I knew very well what the symptoms were, and I volunteered through eagerness. And Jack had said that he was going to sting himself, and so I was happy to do what my dad was doing. So I was jumping up and down saying, sting me, sting me.
So Jack took the only volunteer keen for the job, until finally someone else was goaded into helping.
They all jumped on and said, come on, Chilla, you're big, you're tough. And so Chilla got railroaded.
Nick Barnes remembers a mild sting, like sea lice, on the inside of his arm.
I think it was 8 minutes. I started to feel discomfort in my stomach. And I went to Jack and I said, hey, Dad, funny feeling in my stomach. And he said, it's too early. He said, you're imagining things. So another couple of minutes later, I went to him and I said, I'm not imagining it.
It seemed to take ages to 10-year-old Nick for his dad to realise the sting was having an effect. And maybe they should get to town.
If you can imagine being punched in the belly and not being ready for it, I ended up lying on the back seat. Yeah, I was decidedly unwell. Not crying, maybe groaning occasionally. And by the time we got to about Smithfield, Chella was vomiting out the window.
And Nick's dad, Jack, the stoic ex-commando, just kept on driving through the pain.
That wasn't Jack's style to stop and complain. I do recall the nerve pains. They were like someone had stuck a pin in your arm and then in your ear and then in your toe, all sorts of places. Most uncomfortable.
The trio pulled up at Nick's home, where a colleague of his dad, another doctor, came by.
He put a cannula in and he injected the pethidine. And I'll never, ever forget that feeling. It was like somebody just took all these bricks off your chest. It was just the most amazing feeling.
Having gone through that ordeal for several hours, how did you feel about it in the aftermath? Did you feel negative about it at all?
No, not at all. I probably felt a little bit privileged to have been allowed to take part in it. But not overly so. Like, I didn't race around school skiting that I'd been involved.
And your dad, do you know if he ever felt a bit bad about stinging you? Or did he feel grateful to you? Do you know how he reflected on that?
He wasn't that sort of person, Shani. He didn't. I can't remember him ever saying to me, that was well done. It was just, he expected it and you did it. The only thing that I ever got was many years later, probably 10 years ago, we uncovered a letter to his mother, and I had moved into the house that she owned in Brisbane, and his comment was, you'll find he has no manners, but he's got plenty of guts. And that brought tears to my eyes because that's the only time that he ever made a comment about what he thought. He was very complex, but he was an amazing person and he saw things in a different way and he thought about things in a different way. So I'm very proud of what he was able to achieve and how he did it. I was pleased to play my part in that. Yeah, just proud.
Nick Barnes there, the son of Cairns GP Jack Barnes, who in the 1960s discovered that the mysterious and excruciating illness affecting beachgoers was actually caused by the sting of the Irukandji jellyfish. And that story was from Shani Kim. And we finish the program with a tall tale. Tourists driving through some of the towns in South Australia's mid-north and upper York Peninsula might be surprised to see a 20-odd metre tower installed in most people's front or backyards. The TV towers in these areas were once used to pick up the analogue television signal from Adelaide. Ever since Australia switched to digital, the towers have become obsolete, and others even dangerous by becoming unstable over long exposure to the elements. But a few people have found ways to repurpose the towers to give them another life. Port Pirie reporter Vicky Natafalis has the story.
How did you come up with the idea?
Why not? That's all, why not?
Stuart and Annette Craker's back garden in Port Pirie is a tropical oasis in South Australia's mid-north, around 230 kilometres north of Adelaide. Aside from all the lush greenery, it boasts an array of garden decorations, such as lamps, LED lights, mirrors, a rose arbour, and something else you wouldn't expect.
We love reusing, recycling things and having it in the garden, hiding, so you can't see it unless you actually get there.
In the days of analogue TV, towns in South Australia's mid-north and upper York Peninsula faced a geographical conundrum. They were too far to get Adelaide's signal with a standard antenna, but close enough to detect it if they installed a metal monstrosity in their yards. So that's what most people did. And when the Crakers moved to Pirie in the late 90s, their home was no exception.
We've lived here 27 years. Came from North Queensland for Stuart's work as a paramedic.
When we first came to Pirie, I remember coming over the bridge on Three Chain Road, and it was just a sea of aerials, and they'd had a storm prior to us coming here, and all the tops were bent in the same direction.
About 5 years ago, they got their tower cut down along with some trees in their yard.
It was just too far over on the driveway and you had to get around it to get into the carport.
The tower in Mrs. Craker's mother's yard was also getting cut down.
As soon as the top came off Mum and Dad's tower, it was just so beautiful, and it's just another part of the garden, just another layer. The birds love it. They sit all over it and fight for positions.
Theirs was sort of a bit more rusty, rustic, so we thought we'll have their top. Mum's very envious that she didn't keep it.
Dave Carwiner is a long-time Pirie local and worked in the television industry for years. He can tell the tale on how the towers came to Pirie and how they worked.
Channel 9 started to broadcast in 1959 in September in Adelaide. They were the first in South Australia, NWS 9. So then the local Pirie people couldn't be beaten by the city having TV and us not, because TV was very exciting at the time.
It was believed that Federation Hotel in Port Pirie offered the highest point in town.
Channel 9 was transmitting from Mount Lofty in Adelaide, which was the highest point around Adelaide. And we thought, well, the highest point of Port Pirie, maybe, just maybe, we can get a signal. The television signals were designed to go as far as Port Wakefield, and that was the cut-off area or the fringe area of Adelaide TV. If you received a signal in Port Pirie, it was purely fortuitous. If you got a signal, great. If you didn't, bad luck. Lofty's up high, Port Pirie is up high, but there's still a curvature of the earth in the way. There's a path through the hummocks, through Lock Hill, where they think the signal bounces through the hills. That's why it gets to Port Pirie so well.
That's when some local entrepreneurs reached for the skies, installing TV towers for all. But to get the Adelaide signal, the towers had to be extremely tall, and to stay standing, they were built to certain ratios.
So there was a ratio of how deep the footings had to be as to how tall the tower was. So it was a 50-foot tower, you had 5-foot deep footings.
Mr. Carwiner has converted his to an amateur radio tower. But without regular inspections, he says not all of the towers around town are standing stable.
The towers were made of water pipe, and the top of the towers used to be either have corks stuck in them or they were welded up. If the cockies ate the corks out of the top of the tower, the water would get in, collecting the legs of the tower, and eventually you had a corrosion issue from the inside of the tower.
When it comes to council intervention, Barunga West Council CEO Mari Walkup says there's not much they can do, but the towers haven't posed many problems.
We can only ask somebody to remove it if it's unsafe. So, and then we can put a notice on somebody if they don't, or we can actually go in there and remove unsafe towers if they're a problem and if the property owner refuses to do anything about it. But I've only had one unsafe tower in my time with local government. That's 4 years. And the property owner was quite happy to remove the tower. My memories of the towers was they were fantastic play equipment. My brother and I used to climb as high as we could. We got a ball stuck on the roof. It was an easy way to retrieve our balls. They were just something that we grew up with and climbed on a daily basis.
How many towers do you think are in your council area?
Oh, wow. I think there'd be over 1,000, definitely. I live in the Coffs Coast region and there's towers all over the place. It's funny, isn't it? You don't notice something unless you're thinking of it. But yeah, there would have to be thousands. I reckon we'll see these TV towers in regional South Australia for the next 50 to 100 years.
Port Pirie reporter Vicky Natafalis with that story. And that is Australia Wide for this Tuesday. I'm Alex Hyman. Michelle Stanley will be presenting the program for a few days. I'll be taking a little bit of a break, but I look forward to joining you again next week. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.